Let's begin this afternoon by turning over to Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3, let's take a look at this one verse. Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 3, we read the following. It says, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things which are seen were not made of things which are visible." In the beginning, there was nothing. Before creation, there were two spirit beings, and that was it. No earth, no heavens, nothing. That's all that existed. And then what we end up finding is from there, we find creation as we see and we understand recorded, again, in scriptures in Genesis that tell us what God had done. On this Day of Atonement, I would like to ask all of us a question. And it's the question that I will answer in the sermon this afternoon. What kind of a world would it be if there was no sin? What kind of a world would it be if there was no sin? Now consider that for a moment, because at the moment in time where there were two spirit beings, there was no sin. And even at the time of creation, there was no sin. It was only shortly after sin would enter into the world that we find things began to spiral out of control for 6,000 years. You know, Atonement is a holy day that sometimes gets, I think, shortchanged because it's sandwiched between the Feast of Trumpets and the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day. Now, when we think about the Feast of Trumpets, it's a glorious time. It's a time that is pivotal. We'll chalk that up to no food and water, not that I normally talk like that. It's pivotal because, again, it's picturing the return of Jesus Christ. And, of course, the Feast of Tabernacles and all of its glory with the 7 days that picture the millennial restoration of all things, that's a fantastic and a wonderful time that we long for. And of course, the Last Great Day, picturing that time when these graves will open and literally billions upon billions of human beings will be resurrected and have that opportunity to be a part of God's family. So the meanings of these days on either side are, I mean, you can look at it from a standpoint of just a great sort of exuberance with everything that happens and occurs. Atonement is a day that sometimes gets shortchanged. Now, maybe it's because we're afflicting our souls today. We're fasting. And maybe it's something that we don't necessarily look forward to. And yet the meaning of this day is so pivotal, as well as the Feast of Trumpets, because unless this day happens and occurs, how can the beauty of what we see in the millennium truly take place and not be undone by Satan? The reality is that this day and all that it pictures once again shows us the completeness of God's plan and the perfection in terms of his plan and what he intends to do for all mankind. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. Let's look at that world for a moment before sin entered in. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. The very first scripture, the very first verse in our Bibles. The statement is made, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And it was good, wasn't it? James chapter 1 and verse 17 tells us that every good and perfect gift comes from God. This was not sort of a draft, this first creation that he went into here that we read in Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1. This wasn't that, well, let's try it this way and see if it works, and if it doesn't, we'll do it another way. It was good. God created absolutely. There was no chance. There was no happenstance. There was decency. There was order. That is what God does. Everything had its place in his creation. Let's notice over in Isaiah chapter 45. Let's go there for a moment. Isaiah chapter 45. Isaiah chapter 45, and notice verse 18. Isaiah chapter 45 and verse 18. It says, "For thus says the Lord, who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who has established it, who did not create it in vain, who formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is no other. This world was created in order to be inhabited. Here in verse 18 of Isaiah chapter 45, we see God's attitude towards creation. It was not done in vain. We see that he had a purpose for the creation. Now let's turn to Ezekiel chapter 28. Let's go over to Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel chapter 28 and verse 11. He says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me," Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 11, "saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardis, topaz and diamond, beryl, onyx and jasper, sapphire, turquoise and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones." Now stop to that particular point. This was part of God's creation as well. This being, this angelic being, this archangel was good. Everything you read from verses 11 to 14 tells us it was good. He was a perfect angelic being. He was a light bringer. The verses there in verses 11 through 14 tell us that he had wisdom, musical talent. He had beauty. But something happened. Something happened. Notice over in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. Up to this particular point, we don't find sin. It has not entered into creation. We saw that everything was good. Everything was created for a reason and for a purpose. That was the attitude that God created it. He created the earth in order to be inhabited. He created Lucifer for a reason. And yes, he was perfect at the time he was created. But Isaiah chapter 14, we begin to see a turn. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the cloud, above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." So now we have this perfect creation of God and these ugly, sinister thoughts, ideas, attitudes begin to fester. And they're going to create a problem. Turn over to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12, notice in verse 3. We're seeing a timeline here. I've taken you, if you haven't figured it out already yet, we're seeing a timeline. Two spirit beings, perfect, nothing else around. The earth created, perfect. Lucifer created, perfect. Now we begin to see the downfall. We already read in Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, these sinister thoughts, sinister ideas, attitudes festering, and they reach critical mass. Notice here, Revelation chapter 12 and verse 3, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head, on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born." Let's drop down to verse 7. "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought. And they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Here we find in Revelation chapter 12, in the verses that we've just read, that you've gone through with me here, we find a type of what happened back in Genesis chapter 1 between verses 1 and verses 2. Because what we find is that there was tohu and bohu, as it was called in the Hebrew, back in verse 1. We saw destruction, or we see destruction. We find a situation here in which war breaks out. Let's go back for a moment to Genesis chapter 1. That which was perfect would all of a sudden come to naught. It would be destroyed as this great being would decide that he would go to war against God the Father. Genesis chapter 1, and notice verse 2. He says, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." This earth was without form. It was void. It was darkness upon the deep. This is the end result of what sin brought. It was not that way in verse 1. The attitudes, the rebellion, the festering of everything that went on with Lucifer creates what we see here in verse 2. And it was a violent destruction. So violent, as it says there in verse 2, that the earth was without form and void, and it was darkness that was on the face of the deep. Earth's crust down deep being thrust up into the air. Trees being pulled right out and thrown about. Earth pockmarked with the violence that would take place. You know, you talk about wars and the savagery of war and the damage and chaos that it creates. But I would submit to you, there is nothing. There is nothing. There is no war in the history of mankind that can compare to that war that took place when sin entered into the equation. When Lucifer decided he would go after God and try and take the throne. That latter half of verse 2, it says, "And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." You see, God hates and despises disorder. He's perfect. He does not want disorder. There is nothing about creation that he did from a standpoint of disorder. Let me share some verses with you here, beginning in chapter 1 and verse 10. I'm going to go through these rather quickly. Genesis chapter 1, verse 10, "And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good." Notice verse 12, "And the earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good." Verse 18, "And to rule over the day, and over the night, and to divide the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good." Verse 21, "So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind," verse 25, "and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind, and God saw that it was good." Verse 31, "Then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was good." What does this show us? What do these six verses show us when we see recreation? God loves order. He loved his creation. And he keeps referring to that fact over and over again by virtue of the statement that he makes in all six of those verses that I read to you when he said, "It was good," or "it was very good." Notice over in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. Romans chapter 1, let's take a look at just one verse here. Verse 20, he says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." God speaks through his creation. One of the things that we understand and realize in terms of the proof of God is creation. We cannot deny certain things from creation and say there had to be intelligent design that took place by an intelligent creator. It did not just happen. It did not just occur. You can take you can buy these in the store now. You can get these little Lego sets where you put the Lego pieces together and they form something. You know, maybe a vehicle or a plane or whatever it might be, a building. You can't take all those pieces, shove them in a paper bag, and just shake them around for 20 minutes, and boom, they come out with whatever's on the picture on the box. Arbitrary evolution. It doesn't work that way. There has to be intelligent design of a creator to put certain things together in a certain way. So God speaks through his creation. He has done that. We see that in chapter 1 by the various things that he put together and said, these are good. And again, as I said, we can see analogies and parallels to what we see through him in terms of his creation today. So now we come back to the question that we have the situation that occurred. There was creation. We find that Lucifer rebelled against God. Sin entered into this great archangel and destruction occurred, but God created or recreated, as we see there in Genesis chapter 1. The question then is, how did that sin enter into man? Let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. Notice beginning here in verse 1. Genesis chapter 3 in verse 1. It said, now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Now this cunning, again, from the Hebrew, is it's crafty, it's subtle. So sin is going to enter in through Satan, or the serpent, broadcasting this attitude first to the woman to get her to question whether or not God indeed had given them a command, given them a rule, told them that they were not to do certain things. Verse 2, and the woman said to the serpent, we may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. Quoting him directly. Then the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. Oh, counterintuitive information now enters into the situation. This is not what God said. But he's got to back that up from a standpoint of making it enticing to her. He can't just simply say, well, that's what God says, but here's what I say. He's going to try and reason with an attitude to come in, an attitude of rebellion, but he's going to make it appear from a standpoint of enticing to the woman. Notice verse 5. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. What we see here is that this serpent, Satan, would broadcast an attitude. He would broadcast a spirit of rebellion. And then he would simply sit back and he would watch the destruction as sin entered into the heart of the first man. He didn't actually do the physical act of taking that fruit from the tree. That was Eve. And then giving it to Adam. But what he did was broadcast in a spirit with an attitude and allowed that to fester for a while, saying, yeah, he doesn't want you to eat of that tree because he knows you're going to be just like him when you do that. Once the enticement took place, then everything else, the physical action, went from there. Notice Ephesians chapter 2 over for a moment. You hold your place in Genesis chapter 3. We'll be back there in a minute. Ephesians chapter 2. Chapter 2, and notice verse 2. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 2, he says, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. So the actual act themselves, it's like we say, we take a look at the world around us today and the acts of violence or disobedience, those are being influenced by Satan, but they are literal, physical human beings that are doing them. The attitude of defiance against God, saying God's lying to you, and this is the reason why he's lying to you, That's what was introduced. This spirit of rebellion, the spirit of disobedience was introduced by Satan. But the person goes and they bite on that. The spirit of disobedience, that spirit has not gone away. In 2020, it is alive and well. In the 21st century, it has been magnified and it is being broadcast to billions and billions of human beings on the face of the earth today. So nothing has changed from the Garden of Eden forward. It is simply magnified in terms of the spirit of disobedience, in terms of the spirit of chaos, in terms of the spirit of rebellion. Everything we see happening today can be charted right back to what we just read in those first five verses of Genesis chapter 3. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 3. What was the end result of the serpent's actions? Genesis chapter 3. This is a time again we're talking about when sin entered the world. What would it be like when sin doesn't enter the world? Think about that as we're going through this afternoon. Genesis chapter 3, let's pick it up here, the end result, after everything happens, after God again has his discourse with Adam and Eve in the garden. Notice beginning in verse 15, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, God speaking to the serpent, beginning in verse 15, he says, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of from which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return." What was the end result of the serpent's actions in Genesis chapter 3? Well, we see two things from what we just read. First of all, we have a situation where it was told that there would be sorrow with children. And secondly, we find that the ground would be cursed. Thorns, thistles, bugs, viruses, the like. A degradation of the ability for man to grow food and to have the challenges that we have today. Again, those go into a long discourse over the challenges that the world has today in terms of growing food and trying to take care of all of the inhabitants of the world and trying to grow the food or get the food necessary. The end result of the serpent's actions is we find that Adam and Eve were driven from a beautiful garden. And it was replaced with extremely hard work. All because of what? Because of sin. I want you to think about it just for a moment. Not only did they have this beautiful garden with all of the food that they needed, but they had so many other things that were taken care of for them. They had a job. Their responsibility was to tend the garden. From every indication, they had a perfect climate-controlled environment. We were told that they weren't clothed, so they didn't have to have air conditioning in the summer, and they didn't have to have heating in the winter. So they had to have a perfectly controlled environment. There was no need to worry about, we've got too little rain this year, we've got a drought, or we've got too much rain. They were given a perfect condition. They were given a perfect situation. But when sin entered into the equation, they gave it all up. They gave it all up because of sin. The sin that entered the world with Adam and Eve would not end there, but it would grow and it would magnify. We find in Genesis chapter 4 that it would manifest itself with the first murder that would take place in the Bible. Notice here in Genesis chapter 4, beginning in verse 10. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 10, this is again after Cain had rose up against his brother Abel and had killed him. Genesis chapter 4 and verse 10, he said, God speaking, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond, you shall be on the earth. Sin entered into the equation. It was magnified as an end result of Adam and Eve's offspring. Now, not only we'd go to the sin of going against what God had told them to do, now we move to the point where he kills his own brother. The end result, God refers to him as a fugitive and a vagabond. This ultimate demise of Cain is the second generation of the first sin. Just as Adam and Eve and their sin would be magnified by Cain, we can see down through time that Cain's offspring would magnify his sin. In other words, it would begin to snowball. The snowball on the side of the mountain that begins as a small ball of snow, and as it keeps rolling and keeps rolling and gathering that snow, it gets bigger and it gets bigger and it gets bigger. With Cain's state as being a vagabond and fugitive, a separation was set up. A separation between him and a separation between God. Cain would be driven into a meager existence. Let's ask a question now as we're going through this progression of thought. What ultimately does sin do? Notice in Genesis chapter 6, let's move over a page or two in your Bible, Genesis chapter 6, we are going to now find the flood, the Noachian flood, where God has simply become distressed as an end result of humanity and the evil that he sees on the face of the earth that he has created. Notice Genesis chapter 6, beginning in verse 5. Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. You know, you come to a point of realizing there's not many times we read about in the Bible where it says God is literally grieved in his heart, to the very core of his being. And yet that's the point that he had gotten to. This progression of sin, as we see, going all the way back to who? Lucifer. And it's a progression down through time, moving on and on and on and on and on and on. Let's look at verses 12 and 13, the same chapter. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all the earth had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Think about that for a moment. What we read back in Genesis chapter 1 in those six verses, that God created those things and he says, this is good. It's very good. And now we've moved to the point where sin has entered in and it has gotten so severe, so strong, so magnified, even from the Garden of Eden, that God is going to use the earth and destroy man. He would use the earth to destroy man. What would happen? Well, we would find that flood would take place. You go back, you can see the fossils that still exist on this earth today. You can find mastodons that were found in the Arctic with tropical vegetation. How is that even possible? But you begin to see the destruction. Down through time, we found that the weather patterns have changed for the worse. Before the flood, remember the Garden of Eden, it was as if God had created this perfect environmental bubble. Perfect temperature, perfect humidity, perfect rainfall, perfect everything. And this changed for the worse. After the flood that we read about and continuing down through time, we also find that the lifespan of man has gone down drastically. It's gone down drastically. When you consider what occurred during the time of Genesis and you read some of those genealogies and understand how long individuals lived in their physical lives. Now think about that compared with today, and you see how everything has just disintegrated and degenerated downward. We come to a realization, and that is that this is not God's world. While he created it, we find that man has destroyed it. He has destroyed it by what means? By sin entering into the equation. Since sin entered the world in the Garden of Eden, we recognize that it has all transpired, all these things have transpired, and it is not of God. It simply is not his world today. Man has destroyed it. You know, when we think about the Feast of Trumpets that we just kept 9 days ago, it pictured a time prior to the Feast of Trumpets where we look to the prophetic things that would happen and occur prior to the coming of Jesus Christ. We had seven seals, we have seven trumpet plagues, and of course we have the seven last plagues. Now, if you look at the seven seals, we understand that the first five seals deal with the sins of man. These are all caused by Satan. Think about it for a moment. The first seal, the white horse, is false religion. The second seal, the red horse, is whore of war. The third seal, the black horse, is war's consequences or famines that occur as an end result of war. The fourth seal, the pale horse, is disease. The fifth seal, religious persecution. These are all things that, again, deal with the sins of man. They are brought or caused as an end result of Satan. That is the source. That is the source. Now again, the sixth and the seventh seal, we begin to see that God begins to intervene. But the trumpet plagues and the seven last plagues, God begins to deal with the sins of mankind that have come from where? What source? What lifeblood? From that perfect archangel that was created by God, who was perfect in every way until iniquity was found in him, until sin entered into the equation. Notice Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah chapter 24. Isaiah chapter 24, notice beginning in verse 5. Isaiah chapter 24, beginning in verse 5. He says, "The earth is also defiled under its inhabitants because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, the curse has devoured the earth, and those who dwell in it are desolate. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left." This is a condition that tells us that the earth has been broken down. We see that today. Go to a developing nation, or what they call developing nations now, which are really third world nations with third world countries, and we find that the earth is broken down in those nations. We're seeing that in this nation today. This nation is being broken down. Notice continuing in verse 16. "From the ends of the earth we have heard songs, glorious to the righteous. But I said, I am ruined and ruined. Woe to me, the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Indeed, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Fear in the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall be that he who flees from the noise of fear shall fall into the pit. And he who comes up from the midst of the pit shall be caught in the snare. For the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth are shaken." How true that is. The earth today, we see the very foundations that we hold dear to are being shaken. And we've seen that evolution over time that has been taken away, that God has been pushed out of the equation. God has been pushed out of everything. This is the end result of sin entering into the world. This is what it looks like when sin rules the world. When the author of sin rules the world, that being Satan. Verse 19, "The earth is violently broken. The earth is split open. The earth is shaken exceedingly. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, like a totter, like a hut. Its transgression shall be heavy upon it, and it will fall and not rise again." Isaiah speaks again prophetically of an earth that is broken down in chaos. In chaos. Notice over in Romans chapter 8. Let's go over to Romans chapter 8 for a moment. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Notice beginning in verse 21. Romans 8 verse 21. He says, "Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." So again, Paul is making the statement there that even now at this particular point as he's writing this, and so much more so even in the 21st century, we are finding that the world is in bondage to corruption. Notice what he says in verse 22. He says, "For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now." As a woman goes through childbirth, sometimes there's those pangs that are so hard and severe, she's crying out and screaming in pain. And then there's a stop for a period of time before that next contraction comes, and there's that pang of birth pain. The earth travails, it groans. Why? Why? Because this is what it looks like when sin enters into the world. This is not a world that is God's. This is a world that is led by Satan. Notice over in Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, and let's take a look at two verses here. Matthew chapter 24, verse 21 and 22. Matthew chapter 24, verses 21 and 22. Notice beginning in verse 21, he says, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been seen since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless these days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." We find a time here that Jesus Christ is speaking about in which sin has had to come to the full. We talk about the point of how much longer can we go? How much more before this is the end? And we simply say, well, it has not come to the full yet. Here in Matthew chapter 24, verses 21 and 22, Jesus Christ tells us very clearly, when it has come to the full, then there must be an intervention to come. This is the world that we live in today. This is the world that mankind lives in today. This is a world that sin lives in, that exists in, that thrives in. So the question is, what will the world look like without sin? What will the world look like without sin? Notice over in Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3, beginning in verse 20, he says, "And that he may send Jesus Christ, who was preached to you before, whom heaven must receive until the times of restoration of all things which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began." There must be a restoration. There must be a restitution of all things. We find that for this to happen, for this verse to be fulfilled, which we understand and realize is part of the millennial prophecy that will take place during that 1,000 years that we will picture at the Feast of Tabernacles, beginning Friday evening, something must happen and something must occur. Total deception and destruction has to be taken away, because that's what's happened and occurred for full and complete restoration to have to take place. Restitution or restoration in the Greek means of the perfect state before the fall. Now, again, when we look back in history from man's perspective, when was the last perfect state that existed, physically speaking, upon this earth? Can we not say it was the Garden of Eden? Can we not say it was the Garden of Eden? We read in Genesis chapter 1 that 6 times God said, "It is good. It is good." So in order for us to be able to deal with the restoration of all things, that source that will destroy anything good or that is good must be removed. It must be taken away. When we come to understand atonement, there are 3 particular stages of atonement that we will sort of look at. Let's notice over in Revelation chapter 20. Now, what do I mean by these 3 stages of atonement? Well, let's go through this here to understand these 3 stages of atonement. First, we're going to find the first stage of atonement. We're going to find a physically removing the source of sin from the equation, removing him from the scene. Again, if you have a source that is pumping out something, pumping out attitudes, festering things, allowing rebellion and the spirit of disobedience to breathe upon the earth, as much as you try to restore something, that counterbalance is going to come in to destroy what you've restored. Therefore, the first stage of atonement, you have to physically remove that being from the scene. Revelation chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. God hates anything that exalts itself in a prideful or arrogant way. Did he hate Lucifer? No. But he hated the being that Lucifer became, because that being was corrupted with sin. A world without sin will have pride and arrogance flattened. It cannot coexist in the kingdom. God does not want it, nor will he have it in his kingdom. Thus, the restoration also includes the ability to link all of these people together so they can be at one with each other, but you cannot have that as long as you have the spirit of pride and arrogance that sits there. God hates anything that exalts itself in a prideful or arrogant way. Therefore, a world without sin has to have pride and arrogance flattened. It has to be removed from the equation. And literally, we see here in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3, that is the actual physical removal of the source of sin from this earth. Notice Isaiah chapter 35. Notice beginning in verse 1. He says, "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose." Now, remember what we read back in Genesis chapter 4, when Cain was told by God, "You will be a fugitive and a vagabond. You will sweat your brow trying to work the earth in order to survive." That's the end result of sin. Here we find a restoration. When the source of sin is taken away, this restoration that we're speaking about is going to be happening in the next holy days that we will keep the Feast of Tabernacles. "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be made glad, and the desert will rejoice and blossom as the rose." Notice verse 5. "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing, for water shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water in the habitation of jackals, where each lay, there shall be grass with reeds and rushes." So here we find a physical, but also I would submit to you a spiritual healing upon the earth. You see that statement that is made there where it says, again, the waters which should burst forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. How much wasted earth exists on the earth today that is classified as desert? The Gobi, the Mojave, just to name a few. There's no use for it. What kind of use could be made with that land once it is healed? Once this curse and once this situation of sin and what is entered into through sin is taken away. Again, you find a restored earth from this plague of sin. Notice over in Zephaniah chapter 3. Zephaniah chapter 3, let's pick up one verse, verse 9. Zephaniah chapter 3, beginning in verse 9. He says, "For then shall I restore to the peoples a pure language, that they all may call on the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord." You know, one of the most interesting things that happened to me was back in 2011, and I had not been back to Canada in some time. And I remember flying from Salt Lake City, where we were living at the time, where I had to go up, and I had been given the responsibility of caring for the people in Western Canada, and again, majority of them being in Alberta. And I remember flying from Salt Lake City into Calgary, Alberta, to the airport there in Calgary. I remember getting off the plane, you of course have to come through Canadian immigration. And I remember it was just incredible to me. You walk in there, and there on all these signs, and you've got the LEDs that were going up telling you what to do and where to go, you know, where you had to go, particular line you had to be in. And I counted 6 different languages. 6 different languages. Now, what was interesting to me was that Calgary, Alberta is a relatively small city in the country of Canada. In fact, I don't think it's one of the top 3 in terms of population. It's a relatively small city. But here we find 6 different languages in this one little city in Canada. How many languages exist on the face of the earth? How many times have you had to travel somewhere and, you know, you're going somewhere and you're English speaking and you're sitting down and they lay the menu in front of you and, you know, do you have anybody that speaks English? and some of the challenges that you face when you're dealing with something like that. Here we find it's a restored situation where people are not divided as an end result of language. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9 tells us there'll be one language, one pure language. People have become divided down through time. We have no indication that Adam and Eve only spoke one language. That was it, right? They didn't have to speak multiple languages. We find what happened and occurred when everybody had to have their own language, their own culture, their own customs. Here we find a restoring of a world with one language. Let's go back to Revelation chapter 20 now for a moment and pick up the second stage of atonement. Remember, I said there was three stages. Revelation chapter 20, and notice beginning here again in verse 1. We read that in verse 1 where he is chained, he is cast down. And notice we want to pick it up in verse 3. It says he's cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while, or we call it loosed for a season. Revelation chapter 20 shows us something. It shows us that Satan is loosed for a season, but then we also find that he is cast away. We'll read about that in a moment. We find that there is a second resurrection. We find that there is that third resurrection, hell actually setting fire the heavens and the earth so that a new heavens and a new earth is created. Let's take a look at this third stage of atonement, 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. So we have this loosing for a season, but now we find this third stage of atonement where fire is going to destroy all sin. Remember, he is going to be loosed for that season, try and gather the armies of the world to battle God one final time. 2 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. He says, "But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." Again, shows the love of God, that his desire is that none should die. But they have to come to repentance, and they've got to turn to him. Verse 10, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it, and will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat? Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells." So we have a third stage of atonement. We've had that first stage where the physical being, he's removed from the scene. We have the second stage where he is loosed for a season. But again, he is thwarted. And this third stage is where fire destroys all sin. Satan is not burned in that lake of fire. What is his fate? Let's go back to Leviticus chapter 16. Leviticus chapter 16. It's important to draw the correlation between the Old Testament with regards to this day and the New Testament, and we have a parallel that exists in terms of the way the two goats were treated here in Leviticus chapter 16. Again, something that we review every day or every year on the Day of Atonement. Leviticus chapter 16, notice beginning in verse 5, and he says, "And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats as a sin offering and one ram as a burnt offering. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord and the other lot for the scapegoat." That's an interesting side that we'll look at at another time, another Day of Atonement, is why they cast the lots. "And Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell, and the lot, and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement upon it, and to let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness," or as we often refer to as the Azazel goat. And Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house, and shall kill the bull as the sin offering, which is for himself. Then he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Lord, with his hands full of sweet incense, beaten fine, and bring it inside the veil. And he shall put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side, and before that mercy seat he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger seven times. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, bring its blood inside the veil, do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he shall make atonement for the holy place, because of the uncleanliness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions, for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanliness. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself, for his household, and for all the assembly of Israel. Again, going on here, verse 19, verse 20, where it talks about sprinkling some of the blood, he'll make an end to the atoning of the holy place, verse 19, and he shall bring the live goat. Verse 21, Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel. In other words, all of the sin. Remember that. There's the parallel we have to understand between Leviticus 16 and Revelation chapter 20. All of the iniquities of the children of Israel and all of their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. The goat does not die at the hand of man. It is released with all of the sin into the wilderness, where, again, it does not interact with mankind any further. Now notice over in Jude. Let's go to Jude. Let's take a look at two verses here in Jude. Again, we're looking at this third stage. Jude, verse 6, he says, "And the angels who do not keep their proper domain," meaning demons, "but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day." Verse 13, "Raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars, for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever." Another way of saying a wilderness. You see the parallel between Leviticus chapter 16 that we just read, where all of the sins that had been confessed and were put on that goat were led out into the wilderness. Here we find all of the sin with the source of that sin, who is put there and is in darkness forever. A great torment. A torment because the author of sin and everything that he has done over the 6,000 years knows that the restoration of all things is going on, that God's family is living out into eternity, and there's nothing he can do about it. It is the greatest sense of justice that we could see in terms of what God does, I believe, in his plan. That being is not destroyed. That being is left to torment forever, knowing that we, as his family, live on into eternity, because we, again, and all mankind, are at one with God, without sin in the picture. He can never be allowed your physical creation ever again. That's what a world without sin looks like. Let's conclude by turning over to Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21. Let's begin in verse 1. Revelation chapter 21. What does a world without sin look like? Well, this pretty much capsulizes it, these next eight verses. "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. Because the source of all of it is in darkness, tormented forever. Then he who sat on the throne said, "Behold, I make all things new." And he said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Revelation chapter 21 tells us what we look forward to. It tells us that that is a world that has no sin. There are no barriers. There are no boundaries that can separate mankind. We look forward to God's kingdom. We look forward to eternity. We look forward to that eternity filled with light, free of darkness, a world free of sin. Wherever you were headed for this Feast of Tabernacles and last great day, on behalf of my wife and myself, I ask you to be safe, but I ask you to rejoice at this Feast of Tabernacles and last great day.